This is PGI. Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good morning, and thank you for joining the Hospice New Zealand Palliative Care Lecture Series. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for the continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. Please be advised that today's call is being recorded the 4th of June, 2015. I'd like to turn the conference over to your speaker today, Anne Cullen. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you very much for inviting me to give this presentation. My name is Anne Cullen. I'm a registered social worker, and I'm head of psychosocial and spiritual care at Princess Alice Hospice, which is in Esher, just outside London in England. And I'm also chair of the UK Association of Palliative Care Social Workers. As you can see, the title of my presentation is A Chameleon in the Team, What Social Workers Have to Offer in Palliative Care. I'm going to begin the presentation with a published quotation from a palliative care social worker that I think will give you a sense of where we're coming from and what motivates us as palliative care social workers. So please could you go now to slide 2. The quote comes from an article in the Guardian newspaper where a palliative care social worker, Diana Murungu, describes a day in her working life. She says, "I became a social worker to support people to live their lives as fully as possible despite limitations. The philosophy behind specialist palliative care social work is that people wish to die what they themselves define as a good death, and that families need support to cope with the loss of their loved ones. Based on the biopsychosocial model of illness, specialist palliative care social work uses patients' narratives to identify their sources of pain and to establish their priorities, then support them in achieving their goals." I think that's a good summing up of what palliative care social workers set out to do. It tells you that our starting point as palliative care social workers is to find out what really matters to the people that we're there to help and what needs to happen in order for them to have a good death, not just in the sense of what happens in their last hours and minutes, but how they can live as well as possible for whatever time is remaining to them. And it tells you that we come at our understanding of what really matters to people by supporting them to work out their own narratives, or in other words, to tell their own stories in whatever way is helpful to them. The biopsychosocial perspective means that as social workers, we're interested in the psychological, emotional, social, cultural, and spiritual dimensions of people's lives, because we believe that all these facets contribute to shaping the way they feel and what matters to them. That includes even how people experience physical pain. Pain can feel worse, for example, if you're desperately worried about being unable to pay the rent or the mortgage on your family home, or if you're burdened by guilt for something that you did or that you failed to do years ago, and you're seeing your illness as some kind of punishment for that. So we'll work with people in relation to any of these dimensions. And then finally, I think it tells you that we as palliative care social workers see death not as an individual but as a social event that has a profound and lasting impact on other people who are close to the dying person. So we think it's important to support them too. Could you go now to slide 3?
Pardon the interruption, Anne. I've been asked, can you please, if by any chance, please speak louder into the conference?
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. So, I'm now on slide 3. This slide sets out the way that I'm going to structure the rest of this presentation. In the next few slides, I'm going to explain the chameleon image in the title by talking about 4 different features of palliative care social work that combined can make it hard for people to get a clear picture of what we do. After that, I'm going to do my best to try to alleviate that problem by taking palliative care social work apart and then putting it back together again. I'll take it apart by telling you a bit about the underpinning knowledge and skills base of the social work profession, and then describing what I see as the prevailing model of practice within palliative care social work specifically, and the main elements of this. I'll put the picture back together by describing some examples of palliative care social workers in action. Firstly, at the level of individual cases, and then in various different forms of service development. So, to begin with the chameleon, the first feature that I'd like to draw your attention to is the range of different activities that palliative care social workers might be doing in the course of a day at work. So please could you go to slide 4. Now, the first set of bullet points on this slide come from the account of her day given by the social worker in the quotation from the newspaper article. In the article, Diana Marungu describes providing one-to-one support to a patient who's experiencing what she describes as spiritual and emotional pain, then sitting in silence with a bereaved daughter who was so distraught with grief that she was literally beyond speech, then going out of the hospice where she was based to go out and facilitate a family meeting in a patient's home with 10 different people, each of which had a different take on what should happen. And then she ended that day by teaching a group of professionals about spiritual and cultural issues in end-of-life care. So I think you can see that that in itself was a busy and varied day. But then the other bullet points are just a random selection of other things that palliative care social workers might have been doing during that day. So some may have been making arrangements for patients' care at home or in a nursing home so that they could be discharged from inpatient units. Others, like one of my own team colleagues recently, may have been working with the police to follow up allegations of a patient being sexually abused by a member of staff in the nursing home where she was living. Others may have been teaching and working alongside colleagues in Eastern Europe, India or Africa to support them in improving end-of-life care in those countries. So I hope that gives you something of a flavour of the variety. I'm going now to slide 5. The next set of quotes gives you, I think, some insight into why there is such a range of different activities. As the quotations show, palliative care social workers, and indeed social workers generally, we pride ourselves on being adaptive and pragmatic in responding to the needs of individual people and to the situations that we find ourselves working in. The chameleon quotes come from two different research projects that I've been involved in, which I think gives you a sense of how much this idea is part of our collective social work psyche. The first quotation under the second heading is actually about child protection social workers, but I think it fits palliative care social workers actually just as well. So what Professor Harry Ferguson is suggesting is that to understand social work properly, you need to see it not as something fixed and static, but as a continuing flow of movement between a succession of different activities. The quote below is from a palliative care social worker who expresses, I think, broadly the same idea when she talks about moving between different locations, so working on the ward, going into people's homes, and weaving in and out of different kinds of support. So social work is adaptive, and it's something that happens on the move. I'm going now to slide 6. The fourth element of the chameleon identity is that palliative care social workers are, in some senses, quite deliberately self-effacing. The quotation on this slide comes from a published study of palliative care social work from the perspective of service users of palliative care social work services. The authors, Beresford, Adshead and Croft, describe in their book how they were at first worried that people seeing their social worker as being like a friend suggested that the social workers might be unprofessional. But looking into their data in more detail, they found that what it really meant was that the palliative care social workers were actually making every effort to fit in with the lives of the people they were supporting. They were meeting them on their own ground. They were focusing on their agendas and even adapting their use of language to be congruent, so that the effect was that the relationship felt as natural and as comfortable as possible. So, having, I hope, explained what lies behind the chameleon image, I'm now going to move on and tell you a bit about our professional knowledge base and skills as social workers. So please go to slide 7. This is necessarily a very summary overview, and apologies, it's about UK social work, but I hope it's not too different in New Zealand. So starting with the knowledge base, and firstly the two ologies, sociology and psychology. As social workers, our interest in sociology is about understanding how people's lives are shaped by the groups and the organisations that they interact with, including their families, the institutions where they're educated and employed, the health and welfare systems that look after them or sometimes fail them, the religious, cultural, political, social affiliations that they choose to make or withdraw from, and their personal informal networks of friends, neighbours, or people with whom they share an important leisure activity. We're particularly interested in how institutions can sometimes disadvantage particular individuals or groups of people, and how they can be influenced to change this. As social workers, our interest in psychology is about understanding how people think, feel, and behave, especially when they're faced with important life challenges. In the context of end-of-life care, these are, of course, the prospects and the realities of loss, death, and bereavement. The next element is law. Social workers need to be well informed about certain areas of the law and to know how to use it in practice. We need to know what the law says about people's entitlements to funding and services and how to intervene if these are not being delivered. We need to know how to use legislation to protect people if they're being avoidably harmed, whether this is done by members of their own family or by people working in health or social care services who are not looking after them properly. In end-of-life care, we particularly need to know how to help people to use the tools that the law provides to enable them to have their wishes respected should the time come when they're no longer able to make or communicate decisions for themselves. Social work practice theory is about how social workers can intervene effectively to support people who are facing problems in their lives. There are various models of social work practice. The main one used by palliative care social workers is traditional casework, which basically involves forming a supportive relationship with an individual person or family, agreeing what needs to be done and working with them to achieve it. But there's also a further element to palliative care social work, which I hope will become evident in the later stages of this presentation. That's that social workers quite often spot that the problems they're dealing with in individual cases are indicative of a wider need or problem. And sometimes that leads palliative care social workers to step up to do something about it at a more systemic level. I think the skills I've listed on the slide are reasonably self-explanatory. As social workers, we need well-developed communication skills to form working relationships with people who are stressed and distressed, and also to influence other people to meet their needs. We need counselling and therapeutic skills to support people with psychological, emotional, and relationship problems. We need empirical and analytical skills to gather relevant information, assess what it tells us, and work out what to do. we need to be able to make well-informed assessments of risk and to intervene authoritatively where that's necessary to protect people or to defend their rights. I think what's on the slide and what I've said already has probably given you a reasonable idea of what our values are, and social workers are a bit notorious for banging on about our values, so I won't do that, but go instead, please, to slide 8. In this and the next two slides, I'm now going to move on to talk about the component elements, specifically of palliative care social work. So communication, some of the case examples I'm going to describe a bit later illustrate how social workers adapt their communication to meet particular needs of individuals, or alternatively to try to optimise the influence that they can bring to bear as advocates for the people that they're supporting. An important element of the working relationship that social workers offer, certainly in palliative care, is containment in the therapeutic sense of providing the kind of quiet but supportive presence that helps people, in the words of Gillian Roosh, who's a social worker and educator, to begin to find ways to bear unbearable feelings and think unthinkable thoughts. Social workers do provide formal counselling and therapy sessions, but more often these kind of moments and conversations happen quite spontaneously in the middle of doing activities like making a memory box, or on the move during car journeys, or in an inpatient unit while the nurse is out of the room. The opening quotation of this presentation highlighted the importance that palliative care social workers place on helping people to tell their story. And there are many ways that that can happen. Often it happens through informal conversations, for example, just sitting at somebody's kitchen table. But other times, social workers involve other specialists, and that can add a further creative and therapeutic element to that process. So one example is a social worker who works with a professional storyteller, and together they run groups for people who are anxious or distressed. And in those groups, people can tell their stories and begin to work through some of the implications. And then in another example, some social workers supported a professional writer to come in and work with a group of stories, a group of patients, I beg your pardon, to tell their stories. And the writer then actually wrote those stories up and they became a book. And then the book became part of an exhibition. And that experience gave those patients a really powerful vindication of their personal stories, and also gave them a tangible legacy that they could pass on to their families. And that links to another aspect of storytelling, which is that social workers also work with patients to help them to create a store of messages and personalised memorabilia that they can leave behind for the people who matter most to them. Please go on now to slide 9. Another important aspect of storytelling is to help people to clarify their wishes and to take some control over the way that decisions will be made for them if they become too mentally or physically incapacitated to speak for themselves. The first three tools that I've referenced on this slide come from the UK Mental Capacity Act 2005. So that's advanced care plans, advanced decisions to refuse treatment, and lasting power of attorney. I think will speak for themselves. The examples that I've referenced on the lower part of this slide are of projects where social workers who themselves work in specialist palliative care services are helping to make those tools more available to people who don't have access to specialist palliative care services. And both of the examples that I'm going to talk about involve skill sharing with other professionals who work in mainstream services, and because of that can reach many more people who need end-of-life care and support. So the first example is a social worker who facilitates one session of a rolling program of group work for people who are in the early stages of dementia. In her session, she uses a creative approach, the conversation game, to help people to get over the psychological barrier of talking about death and dying. And having done that, she then introduces them to the Mental Capacity Act tools that they can use to record their wishes and their decisions while they're still able to do that. The social worker co-facilitates each of those sessions with a different clinical psychologist, so that then in turn each of those clinical psychologists can introduce this approach and use the tools in their own practice with people who are approaching the end of their lives. The second example, the Deciding Right program, which runs in the north of England. In this program, a palliative care social worker and a colleague go out on the road to work with doctors, nurses, social workers, therapists and care staff in mainstream frontline services. And they teach, they mentor, they work alongside those frontline colleagues to support them really to gain the skills and also the confidence that they need to be able to open up conversations about end-of-life choices, and again to use the Mental Capacity Act tools. I'm moving on now to slide 10. Social workers often help people with very practical problems like housing, claiming benefit payments, and getting specialist equipment. An increasingly important part of the work nowadays is supporting and intervening to help people to get their personal care needs met. Unfortunately, funding and provision for personal care in the UK is already complicated, and it's becoming actually ever more so as budgets get more tightly stretched. But getting disjointed systems to work quickly and effectively can make all the difference in someone getting their wish to stay or to get back home to die, or to move into a nursing home that's adequately equipped to meet their needs. Palliative care social workers champion the rights of people who are socially disadvantaged or devalued. So, for example, offenders or people who are dependent on drugs or alcohol. So really people whose needs for end-of-life care are the same as anybody else's, but may not fit comfortably with the way that services are organised. Because of our specialist knowledge and skills as social workers, we generally find that we take the lead within our organisations when there are concerns about abuse or neglect. This is very delicate work, because often the cause of neglect or even violence in families is that people are under intolerable pressure. And unfortunately, the services that are responsible for investigating allegations are not always able to be as sensitive as they really need to be in dealing with dying people and their families. So what palliative care social workers can do is to act as mediators and moderators, so that enough can be done to keep people safe without causing unnecessary further upset. So now I've taken the elements of palliative care social work apart, I'm going to go on to begin to put them back together by talking through some examples of palliative care social work in action. Please would you go to slide 11.
Pardon the interruption, Anne. If you could please speak louder into the conference, that would be lovely.
Okay, I'm doing my very best. Okay, so these examples are all taken from my case study research with a group of hospice social workers. So I'm going to start by talking about a patient who I'm calling Adam. Adam was in his late 30s and he had a partner and young children. He had advanced metastatic cancer and he'd come into the hospice's inpatient unit because it had been impossible to get on top of his pain at home. After several days, and despite the best efforts and the considerable skills of doctors, nurses, and physiotherapists, there was unfortunately no improvement in his level of pain relief. Social worker went in to see him, and she quickly picked up that he was very worried about the situation in his home. Describing this case in the research interview, the social worker referenced the concept of total pain, or in other words, the idea I referred to earlier, that physical pain may be exacerbated by social, emotional, or other factors. So she began to develop a hypothesis that there might be a significant social and psychological component to his pain. She used a psychotherapy tool from cognitive behavioral therapy to check this out and to support Adam in clarifying his own thoughts and feelings. She asked him to rank what was concerning him most at that time, and it soon became clear from this that he was worried about some particular unfinished business at home and where this would leave his young family. Because he'd come to realise that he was dying more quickly than he'd expected. He also simply wanted, above everything else, to be able to die at home. With Adam's agreement, the social worker approached the doctors in the team because they were the decision makers on discharges. She framed her communication with them carefully to show respect for their role, but also to make sure that they were able to appreciate the significance of the new information that she was able to provide. And they agreed to the discharge. The social worker then moved very quickly onto the practicalities of getting funding agreed and getting all the care and support arrangements in place that were needed for Adam to be cared for at home. And quite remarkably, she actually managed to get all of that done within 48 hours of that first conversation. Adam went home and he didn't need to be readmitted. Going back now to the chameleon analogy, you can see, I hope, that the social worker accomplished a significant number of really quite different tasks. But what people may well have seen on the surface was that she had a couple of face-to-face conversations, she filled in some forms, and she made a few phone calls. Please go now to slide 12. In this example, a social worker was asked to visit Bella and her partner Richard soon after Bella had been told about her terminal prognosis. Bella and Richard were both feeling quite overwhelmed by the news. They were feeling as if their whole lives had suddenly been taken over by hospital visits, tests and treatments. So the social worker's first concern was simply to provide some containment for them, to let them pour out their distress, their anger, their bewilderment and their fears, and support them to begin to make sense for themselves of what was going on. One of their biggest worries at that stage was how to talk to their children and prepare them for what was going to happen in the future. Because they felt so overwhelmed themselves, they wanted the social worker to do that for them. But her approach was to explain that they were much better equipped to do that than she was. In the research interview, she explained that she set out to do what she described as normalising the situation. She drew the couple's attention to how well they were doing with the children by just keeping up their usual routines like meals and bedtimes. She did give them some advice about some of the books and activities they could use to help them explain things to the children. But she also deferred to them repeatedly as the experts in understanding what would work best with their own children. And she talked in the research interview about how easy it was for parents to feel de-skilled, and that what she'd done in this case was to do her best to give Bella and Richard back their confidence so that they could take back their role as parents. Thinking back to Beresford, Adshead and Croft's reference to people experiencing their social workers as a friend, it's quite easy, I think, to imagine in this case that although the social worker was actually quite thoughtfully and judiciously drawing on the knowledge and skills of the palliative care social worker's toolkit, what Bella and Richard may well have experienced was that they'd had a reassuringly ordinary conversation with a friendly woman while they sat drinking tea together at their own kitchen table. If you could go now, please, to slide 13. This is the final individual case example. So this example's about Clifford. Clifford was referred to a hospice social worker by a specialist nurse colleague who was at her wit's end about how to care for him. And the social worker's first challenge was to find a way to communicate with Clifford because he'd permanently lost the use of his voice. So she used humour to engage him. She teased him a bit. And then she got him to write notes to her. And that actually opened a floodgate. And he wrote so much that he ended up running out of paper and writing on the back of an empty tissue box. He told her a very sad story about an awful history of childhood abuse, which was why he couldn't bear to be touched or to have people in the house touching his intimate possessions. But that left the very pressing problem of what would happen to him as he became less able to care for himself, and it left the prospect of him dying a horrible and painful death alone at home. The social worker and the nurse agreed that there was no reason to question his mental capacity, so he was entitled to make this choice, but it was still an appalling prospect. The social worker managed to find a way through that by negotiating with multi-professional team colleagues that Clifford could come into the hospice for the final stage of his illness, even though he was not prepared to accept more than minimal care. And she managed to convince Clifford himself that that was the right thing for him. But then, once all of that was done, and Clifford was in the hospice but beyond communicating in any way, the social worker then felt that she was somehow letting him down. So she explained, "When the practical things ran out, I thought, what am I going to do now? How can I support this man? I felt I owed him." But she moved on quite rapidly from this moment of self-doubt. "I thought, yes, I can actually just go and sit in the room with him. That's what was left. I'd done everything else, so all I could do was just be there with him, and that's okay, that's enough." I think this account has real resonances with Holloway and Moss's account of the role of the professional, including social workers, as spiritual fellow travellers, and that's someone who provides a form of companionship beyond words for someone who's going through a particularly harrowing personal journey. And that idea, that concept, seems apt to describe the way that this social worker moved in her work with Clifford from his home to the hospice, from the practical to the contemplative, and how in that way she shared his journey through the later stages of his illness towards his eventual death. Please go now to slide 14. This slide now moves the focus from direct work with service users and their families, firstly to the contribution that palliative care social workers make to the work of colleagues in the multi-professional team. As I think a couple of those individual case examples show, palliative care social workers can enrich the understanding that the team as a whole has of patients and their lives by adding what a doctor I once interviewed referred to as the wider dimension of history, family and community, what the patient is going home to. Secondly, palliative care social workers use their therapeutic skills to provide emotional and psychological containment for colleagues as well as for patients. That's done formally through clinical supervision and by facilitating reflective practice sessions when there's been a particularly difficult experience or death. But informally, one of the non-social worker contributors to my case study research described how the door to the social worker's office was always open, both literally and metaphorically. Colleagues knew that if they felt upset or overwhelmed, they could be confident that if they went in, one of the team would put aside whatever they were doing, however busy they were, and give the time needed to listen and provide support. And then moving on now, beyond the immediate team, the final heading on this slide signposts more far-reaching ways in which palliative care social workers contribute to addressing problems and improving services at a more systemic level. And I'll talk about those in the next slides. So if you could go please to slide 15. Now the first example here is of where a social worker began to pick up anecdotal evidence that made her worried about the way that the hospice she was working in was making decisions about discharging people to nursing homes, because several of the people that she'd worked with had died shortly afterwards. She wanted to challenge this practice, but she realised that to do that successfully, she'd need to provide evidence of a kind that would make a real impression on medical, nursing and management colleagues. As you will probably have gathered, social workers are really by nature we're storytellers rather than willing number crunchers. But in this case, the social worker decided to adapt her method to suit the target audience. So she did a formal clinical audit, and that provided robust quantitative evidence that confirmed her concerns and convinced her colleagues in the hospice to change their practice. She also then went further and with a medical colleague, she published her findings in an article, and that then had the effect of influencing practice more widely. That article's referenced on the next slide. It's the Reith and Lucas article. The second example is that a group of palliative care social workers within the association that I now chair shared experiences that people were dying before they received important disability living allowance payments because the application process was so long and complicated and claims took so long to process. So they orchestrated a national campaign that included a mass lobby of parliament, and they succeeded in getting special rules to fast track those payments for people who deemed to be in the last months of their lives, and that's helped many thousands of people since. Recently and rather poignantly, it's helped one of those people who herself led that campaign. The third example is that a social worker in Glasgow in Scotland and colleagues elsewhere in the country were really concerned that the needs of people with learning disabilities were often overlooked or poorly responded to in end-of-life care. So they set up a national network, and they did it with and also obviously for the benefit of people with learning disabilities. And that network now develops resources, conducts research and provides peer support for people who are interested and concerned about end-of-life care for people with learning disabilities. The fourth example illustrates how social workers have responded to gaps in service that they've become aware of by undertaking research. Social workers tend to favour action research and are also often in the forefront of service user involvement. The quote under that heading is from a video that was produced by palliative care social worker Gillian Chowns with a group of young people during her PhD research project, and that's still actually available on YouTube. I think the title speaks for itself. Finally, on this slide, a number of palliative care social workers are very actively involved in collaborative work with community groups. The quotes under the heading of compassionate communities come from a report that highlights the work of Diana Murungu, the social worker who was referenced earlier in this presentation. And her work's in Birmingham, which is a particularly ethnically and culturally diverse city. I think it gives you a flavour of how that work's being approached, very much as a reciprocal process of mutual learning and co-development. The next slide is taken up with references and links in case you'd like more information about some of those examples. So I'm going to move now straight through to slide 17. This slide offers just a selection of examples of how British palliative care social workers have in the past and are continuing now to contribute to enabling other people to develop their skills and to extend end-of-life care services in the UK, in Europe, and further afield. So Frances Sheldon was a pioneer in the 1990s. David Olivier established the St. Christopher's International Programme during the first decade of this century and is actually still active as an educator in this country, in Europe and in India. And Pamela Firth and Gillian Chowns' work in Eastern Europe and in Africa is very much live and current, more or less as we speak. Slide 18 provides links to more information about these examples and a selected list of books that have been published by British palliative care social workers. So I'm going to move on now to slide 19. So beginning now to sum up, I hope that what I've managed to show is that palliative care social workers draw on a range of knowledge and skills and use them adaptively. So what this slide does is basically summarises the parameters. So the different modalities, therapeutic containment, casework, service development, the different settings, family homes, day services, nursing homes, inpatient units, primary health, community bases, and education settings, and the levels, in working with individuals and families, organisations and communities, working locally, nationally, and internationally. So the different modalities, the settings and levels within which social workers in palliative care may move in the course of their day-to-day work or in the course of careers as palliative care social workers. So if you'd like to know, go finally to slide 20. This slide offers really a final summary of what I've tried to convey in this presentation. And so that is that as palliative care social workers, we work from a holistic or, as I said earlier, a biopsychosocial perspective. We combine or seek to combine psychotherapeutic, empirical and practical skills. Our focus is on enabling people to identify their own priority needs and to achieve what matters most to them. We are active in practice, education, research and service development in various different ways. I hope it's shown that we are mobile, adaptive, and indeed even friendly, and that we as palliative care social workers are possibly at our best and almost certainly at our happiest when we are least conspicuous. So on that note, I'll fade into the background now and give you a chance to ask any questions or to comment on what I've said. So thank you very much indeed for your attention.